Hey Dan, you know what today is?
Fascism Friday.
Yep, Fascism Friday. This December 18th, 2020. And you know what? Like, I don't know, we've heard this, that opening, and it's also our closing music dozens of times now. And I never get sick of it.
You know, Mark, I was thinking the exact same thing.
I mean, because it's like it somehow conveys peace and urgency at the same time.
Yes.
Which I don't know, it describes like the posture with which we need to live in this time better than that.
Yeah. And also to me, it has that feel of, you know, journey in essence.
You're not talking about the prog rock band, are you?
No.
Okay. Because that doesn't sound like journey to me.
No, not that journey.
Okay. No, there is a sense, the little beam of light.
Oh, yeah.
Traversing the digital realm. Trying to reach its destination. And then there's an explosion, and you realize this explosion of insight and wisdom is this broadcast.
And here we are.
Here we are.
So I'm Daniel Wolpert. I direct MICA, the Minnesota Institute of Contemplation and Healing.
I'm Mark Van Stunwyck. I direct the Center for Prophetic Imagination.
And, you know, before we get into the important stuff, you have to go look up this article about snake-infested sea foam on the beaches of Australia. I posted it on my Facebook page this morning. I thought it was a joke.
So there's like frothy sea foam.
It's unbelievable.
And people are walking around and there's like snakes hiding in there.
Yeah.
That's terrifying. Because Australia has all kinds of poisonous shit. Like I was
right, exactly.
Minnesota snake sea foam or Lake Superior foam.
Yeah, no, and it's like 5-6 feet deep, this foam. It's not just like covering your feet.
Is this a climate change thing, or is there always been deep foam?
No, but there's this video from the BBC Weather of these people's dog gets lost in the sea foam because it's so deep with all the snakes.
I'm getting claustrophobic just like you little puppo is like. Yeah.
I mean, we need to do a meme, right? Of you know,
the foam is 2020.
Yeah,
the doggo is the American people, and the snakes are like,
you know, coronavirus,
Trumpian neo-fascism.
Yeah.
Oh my God,
it's incredible. It's just amazing. So you got to go check it out.
It's not that goes way beyond snakes on a plane.
Yeah, and then we need the snakes on the plane overlay.
People are coming. It's good morning to everyone. Yeah, good morning.
Good morning, everybody. It's Spain. Stefan's in Spain, so it's no longer morning. It's already 5 o'clock, and it's dark probably.
Yeah.
So I hope you had a good morning. Your morning is in our past.
So diving in, like, there's a couple ways we could talk about this because, you know, mysticism is not an easily grappable term. People mean different things. Fascism, there's a reason we have to talk about fascism all the time. It's difficult. And to talk about how those two things interrelate is, there's lots of directions we can take, but there's two pieces that I'm hoping we can kind of engage. One is that fascism operates kind of as its own religious mystical system, right? And so when we start talking about Christian mysticism and then talk about how fascism is mystical, there's some similarities that are a little bit unsettling sometimes. The other piece of it is there's this assumption within certain circles that if you're a contemplative practitioner, it'll just open up your awareness to the way the world really is, and then you'll be free from stumbling into the pit of fascism and other things, which is naive. And so we want to use St. Clair, Bernard of Clairvaux as an example of how that isn't always the way it works.
Right. So for those of you who are not aware of who good old Bernard is, sorry, Stefan, for some reason I said you were in Spain. I think it's because I can't really read the comments very easily, and I saw 5 p.m. as Spain. But you're in Eastern Europe. It's probably dark there, too.
I never realized that 5 p.m. in Spain kind of actually look alike.
Yeah, don't they? Sort of? A little bit. Anyway, so Bernard of Clairvaux was the founder of what has become known as the Cistercian Abbey in Clairvaux in France, and that was founded almost 1,000 years ago, and it's a branch of the Benedictine order, a branch that many mystics have been involved in. It's a very contemplative order. Thomas Merton's Abbey was, kind of connected with that tradition. Mm-hmm. Many of the extreme cloistered contemplatives are part of that tradition. And so Bernard is looked at as a great figure in Western monasticism, and his sermons on the Song of Songs. He wrote 99 sermons on the Song of Songs, beautiful explication of love and relationship with yourself and each other and the church and God, and it's great. And he also was the major force behind the Second Crusade, which was a complete horror kind of clusterfuck of religious warfare.
Yeah, and just to give a little, I mean, there's lots of crusades that happened. And the Second Crusade, it started, it wasn't popular. And so Bernard of Clairvaux, his role was basically spokesperson. So he is known as being like an amazing communicator. There's art that shows him, like, they create a platform. People would gather around and he'd give his magnificent oration. And he helped to convince people to do this, but also helped promote and push this idea, probably more than any single figure, the idea that if you can engage in this crusade, there's something salvific about it. Yes. Like, you can shorten your time in purgatory, you can gain just indulgences, like all that kind of stuff. really, which we think of as like part of the most odious aspects of the crusade for on the Christian side, like murdering Muslim people because we don't want them having the Holy Land is bad enough. But then the way that it shaped spirituality at the time was really this buying into if you're willing to murder and do the military thing in the cause of Christ, then that's good for your soul.
Yeah.
Like, that idea is really toxic. And Bernard, who by all other accounts, like if he just didn't have the Second Crusade at all, the stories would all be good about him.
Right.
Like, he'd be this amazing figure. Like, even in these stories you read about him going from place to place to preach to the Crusades, and in between, sick people were getting healed. And he was talking about God's love. Like, it's really,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and so, and if you look at fascist leaders, you always have stuff like this, right? I mean, there are plenty of people that have really, really nice things to say about fascist leaders. They're kind to them. They help their family. They, call them on the phone. They personally came to their house and took care of them. All kinds of really, really nice stuff. There's a level of sort of goodness and hospitality. One of the really fun activities of my youth was that I got to go to this mafia 4th of July party in Newport, Rhode Island.
Like real mafia or?
Yeah. No. The real mafia. So, so the mafia ran Rhode Island for years and years. And one of the big mafia bosses had this mansion in Newport, Rhode Island, which is the home of the largest 4th of July parade in America. And his home was on the parade route, and it's this like walled compound, and there's tennis courts and pools and this huge mansion, all this stuff. And And after the parade, all these figures, he has this huge party, and there's, you know, all the politicians are there. That year, Marvin Hagler, the great middleweight boxer, was in the parade. He came to the party. And so I'm in this party and hear all the, I mean, it looks like a scene out of The Godfather. Like in The Godfather, there are these parties, huge spreads, food. There are all these guys in suits, packing, you know, all these, and everybody's having fun. And it's nice. And it's family and their kids swimming in the pool. And this guy comes up to me, puts his arm around me, says, "Hey, you're a friend of my son. That's great. You have a good time here." You know, and there's this guy carving this enormous roast beef, and he's got this scar that goes all the way across his face.
What? I mean, like a movie.
Yeah, it was. It was exactly a scene out of a movie. And again, it was nice. It was great. You know, it was really fun. And all these conversations, you know, I'm listening and walking around. They're all talking about huge construction projects and government contracts and all this stuff. You know, so there is this, you know, when you're on the inside of this world, yeah, it's nice. It's beautiful. You know, these people are being helpful. And there is this transcendent quality of sort of power and awe and goodness. And and this is a major blind spot. And so there is this mystical quality to all of this, and you can get absorbed, right? I mean, it's mystical absorption. And then you cannot see that you're a fascist.
Yeah, just a few comments coming in.
Yeah.
Mike, good to hear from you, Mike. Great topic. I had always heard about Hitler's fascination with the occult, but I had just assumed it grew from a desire for power. I mean, that's usually how it's depicted in films. It wasn't until the Trump era that I began to see how things like Norris neo-pagan beliefs and thinkers like Julius Evola feed into fascist and nationalist thought. In other words, it is down near the root of fascism, not just something touching the branches. This is important. Like, we talk about Trump, the animating ethos of Trump being hate. And there's something to that. But like, we got to step back and recognize that for a lot of these folks, they really believe they're being motivated by love. And I'll give an example of one of my fascist mystical experiences, because I've had mystical experiences that were of the divine. And I had one that was fascistic. I was at Valley Fair, which is an amusement park outside the Twin Cities. And at the end of the night, they'd usually do a smoke laser show. And they did a laser show of "I'm Proud to Be an American." I was wearing my red, white, and blue rodeo shirt that day, cowboy hat. And as that music played, I started bawling, crying, because I was like, I love this country so goddamn much. And I'm willing to die for this. And in my mind, if you would have named, like, well, what are the things that get in the way of the glories of America being a beacon of light to the world? What are the things that assail us? Well, homosexuals, abortion, Muslims, like all the usual suspects. That would have been what I was taught, you know, have internalized. And so in my mind, out of love, I would have been willing to lay down my life for my country, which I almost joined the military a couple of times. And I would have been willing to kill out because of that love. Yeah. That's very mystical in an evil way, but it's mystical. And so the core of this fascist impulse is it's kind of this weird toxic type of abusive love.
Yeah. Although what I would say is that that's actually not mystical.
I would agree with you.
And that's but it's the kind of thing we associate with mysticism. Right. Yes. That we associate intense emotional catharsis in response to some overarching principle or reality as a mystical experience.
Yes.
And this is one of the reasons why people actually have a really hard time with actual spiritual practice, is that real spiritual practice and mystical engagement is incredibly dry and dull and boring most of the time. It is very rarely emotionally cathartic.
I feel like that I'm having a perpetual mystical experience.
There you go. Yeah, but we associate it with this kind of transcendent emotional sort of release. And that's unbelievably powerful. And right, we associate that with this deep love and this deep desire. Kathleen had a comment up before that I thought was good.
Sorry, I missed that. Kathleen writes, when I was in seminary, I spent a week in a Trappist monastery. They knew nothing about politics and seemed to be happy.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, that sounds wonderful. Like, I can't not be engaged in politics, but I also recognize, like, there's something about, like, you know, we talk about monasticism. People will often say, well, they're detached from the world. Sometimes that's true. Sometimes it's not. But the thing, the beautiful thing, and this is something Dan talks about a lot, is when you're in a community, and if your concern is focused on a local community, you can spend a lot of energy trying to figure out how to learn to love one another in a way that then is something that can be shared with the world. To me, where communities don't know about politics, the only reason it really bothers me is that how are we going to learn from them? Which is part of the problem with monasticism today is it skews very elderly. People aren't replacing them, and I don't know what's going to happen to their charisms once they're gone. But anyways.
All right.
Ceres writes, being a spiritually gifted does not mean that have spiritual gifts will be a pill of character any more than having radical political ideologies is a pill. That's right. Development of character, depth, amending relationships and communities, and being present with desire is what does. Too many tolerated much shortcut thinking and talented asshole phenomena. Yeah, that's the right. Like, that's true. Like, I have a friend who often would. So those of you who ever read Ken Wilber, this is kind of a way of thinking that I don't like, but you know, that there's levels of consciousness and that at the top is color coded. If you get high enough, you're purple. And that means you're an integral thinker, right? And this, you have a level of consciousness that transcends, but includes every previous form of consciousness. So I have a friend who talks that way all the time or used to, and he would say that Dick Cheney is actually integral. Like that he has a very integrated consciousness. That doesn't mean that he's good. Right? You can have, I have no doubt Bernard of Clairvaux had an above average capacity to understand complexities of his world in a way that could have been a peace building relationship, like more like what St. Francis did with the Islamic world. And he could have been an advocate for peace, but he did not, because it's not assumed just because you're a spiritual master that you're righteous.
And yeah. And with
a spiritual master in the way, like, and the kind of the sort of weird disconnected meaning you can sit for 8 hours without moving and meditating the whole time, right, as though that's a goal.
Right. Yep. Yeah. And the other thing that I hear, sir, is you talking about here is another thread to this, which is the issue of authoritarianism, right? And so when you're talking about development of character depth, amending relationships, communities, you know, all of that, that's a very egalitarian, horizontal kind of view that you're describing. And so, you know, and this is one of the very serious, severe blind spots of Western Catholicism spirituality, right? Is that it's happening within this imperialist authoritarian structure, which is almost never questioned. And the people that do question it often found themselves, you know, tied up and burnt. and so, you know, when we talk about discernment, right, we've talked about that a lot. And one of the fundamental issues there is this issue of spiritual indifference, right, that you are trying to not be attached to your own ideas of what is good and bad. And so within this system, though, there is no indifference to the idea of the authority of the Pope. That is assumed that is absolutely always what God is working through. And so that's a tremendous blind spot. And, you know, and as fascism is this very authoritarian impulse, and, you know, that can be very connected to love, right? You know, we love the Father, you know, we want the Father to take care of us and the Fatherland and all of that kind of language. You know, if you have a spirituality that's roped in with that authoritarian impulse, it's very easy to head into this kind of quasi-mystical fascism.
Stefan writes, though Bernard's opposition to Abelard was shitty too, Abelard had a beautiful theory of atonement.
Yeah, so this is kind of a theological nerd commentary.
It's tasty.
Yes, very good. Yeah, there are a lot of different theories of salvation, what we call the atonement. And, you know, we tend to not know that. Mark, you mentioned this yesterday under the fundamentalist make things up, right? We think that substitutionary atonement is the only version of the atonement. But
which is where God wants to beat the hell out of us, but he beats the hell out of Jesus instead. To get it out of his system so he can forgive us and accept us.
It's the ultimate psychotic warlord vision of God. Anyway, Abelard had a very different kind of view. And there have been lots of other views that are great, but
you know, it'd be interesting to talk about sometime, because a lot of people are like, oh, this is theology. But like at the time, just like now, these kind of things become charged with symbolic weight that touch on all kinds of other issues.
Oh, yeah, very so important.
These weren't just like nerds willing to kill each other over theological obscurities. It was much deeper than that. Gus writes, if folks are wanting to learn about the mafia in Rhode Island, check out. Gus, it's like people fill into their roles, and Gus is like the resident film and book and series suggester.
Yeah, so librarian.
Yes.
He's the media librarian for Transmission.
If folks are wanting to learn more about the mafia in Rhode Island, check out season 1 of Crime Town. It's a real trip to hear these guys being at time really nice guys.
Oh, yeah. That was great. Food was great at the party.
I mean, that sounds good. Catherine writes, I love considering theologians in their economic political context. This is tasty goodness. You're just such a nerd. Didn't Bernard also write a whole book about how Song of Songs was metaphor of union between God and the soul, not sexy human erotic poetry? Fun fact, or is this relevant to fascist mysticism? I mean,
well, again, the whole book, it was 99 sermons that he supposedly preached on this. Yeah, and he combined those two things because, you know, at the time, scriptural interpretation had a number of levels, one of which was the metaphorical level. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, all of this, you know, and that's again what we're trying to get at here, right, is that spiritual practice and or what we might call mystical experience does not guarantee that one engages the world in a positive way. I mean, self-absorption can feel very mystical, and it's just a certain form of dissociative behavior. And it can make you actually feel, though, like you know all kinds of stuff that you know nobody else knows, and you're right, and everybody else is wrong. And obviously that is a trademark of fascism.
Yeah, it's fascinating thinking about this kind of, you know, I started out being fast and loose with using the word mysticism to refer to a sort of emotive oneness. And then you kind of said, well, that's not what mysticism. But the thing is how similar that feels.
Right.
Yeah. My operative kind of working starting point when talking about mysticism is that it is actual union between us and other living things, like God, the land, each other. And so it's presence. Now, interestingly enough, if I'm breaking down and crying because I'm proud to be an American, that's not present to anything. That's purely abstracted. That's me feeling union with an idea. And an idea that pulls me away from being able to relate to other people, but it kind of feels the same. And so this is where it's fascinating. Like at one hand, it almost seems exactly the same, but in another hand, it's exactly opposite. Yeah. And this is why it gets really weird and dicey when people start talking about mysticism as just religious experience or a feeling of oneness without having even like a broad philosophy or psychology. Mm-hmm.
Well, and then
contemplative posture is.
Yeah. And then when you not only, so you're at that thing having that experience, and then you're surrounded by 1,000 other people who are also having that experience. So now it's this communal emotional catharsis, mm-hmm. right? And now that becomes this incredibly fertile ground for authoritarian fascist ideas and structures.
You just described like half of the charismatic revivals I've experienced.
Yeah, right. Well, and you know, people have talked a lot about Trump rallies, right? It's exactly the same kind of thing. Yeah.
Ceres writes, there's a book on exposing 45's dark powers and how new thought movement practice and ideologies enabled his ass. That whole land of thought is fascinating. And I feel like when people bring it up, people jump on it, but it's by a former member of Blondie. That just is a double reason for me to read that.
Great.
I still have a crush on Debbie Harry from Blondie. Wiley writes, could fascism be a corruption of a strong sense of community?
Well, see, this is the interesting thing. And what I was just mentioning is that initially it feels and is in some ways a very strong sense of community. Not, you know, and so, so there is this sense of community, but it's a community based on this adrenaline rush and emotional catharsis, right? As you just said, Mark, it's not really a community based on presence. You're not present to anything. You're just having this emotional, emotive experience. Right. And that's why often after these communal rallies, you know, the horde goes out and, you know, kills some people, right? Because it's just this, you know, series, as you're saying, it's this kind of dark power, right? And then what you find, of course, is that there's no community after that, right? So, you know, you come down from the adrenaline rush and then, you know, there's nothing. Right. And that's the con artist part of Trump. Right. Mm-hmm. There's nothing. I mean, he's leaving office with America sick, broke, hacked, in shambles. There's nothing. Right. All those Trump rallies, all that emotional catharsis, all that great stuff. And there's actually nothing there. And, you know, every fascist state, once it crumbles, it's the same thing. There's nothing there at the end of it.
I think, you know, I'm assuming everyone who is a normal listener already can track with this, but I just want to inject this in case there's people listening. This is usually where people start wanting to fall into this easy binary of positive versus negative. And so the idea is all these Trumpers are centering around a negative identification. Like, we're not like those people. And because of that, it's bad and it's toxic. And so instead we need to center and build community around only positive things. And that ignores the fact that those Trump supporters probably are centered around in their minds some positive things.
Oh, yeah.
And it's also this piece like, okay, when James Cone talks about the mysticism of blackness, he's talking about a group of oppressed people who are trying to create community over sometimes in negative opposition to their oppressors. And that's not the same thing. Or David Graeber, who passed away this year, would write about how there was whole ethnic groups like in Madagascar who didn't want to be oppressed by the king. So they went to the mountains and created their own like tribe that was a non-authoritarian and it became an ethnic group. Being against stuff by itself isn't necessarily bad. And this is why having an analysis is important. Like, and why it's, to me, starting with a working definition of mysticism and spirituality that starts with presence, encounter, and assuming that the people and living things in front of us are more real or more important than these abstractions. It's got to be part of the soup. Otherwise, it's not, we're going to fall into these ways of thinking where it's going to be easy to oppress people. And this is, I'm wondering how this new thought book might get into some of that, because there is this weird positivity thinking that you think is somehow noble, but allows you to fall into pits all the time. Julius loves my Valley Fair story. And again, good catch on it not being true mysticism, Dan. Medina writes, I've been fascinated by all of this. You are so correct to point out the naive thinking that all those who partake in contemplative practices arrive at the same truth. Contemplative practices bring out of us what is already at the center, and sometimes that center is not just. I have watched protesters and counter-protesters both praying, and some praying in tongues, and they are praying to presumably the same God, and they're praying in opposite of each other. sit back, waiting, see, and it trails off there.
Yep.
And this is like, you know, I can't remember if this is something we talked about in this episode or if it was before we started this episode, but it's fascinating to me how we really want spiritual practice to be this key that unlocks enlightenment. Like I think a lot of us get involved in some variation of spiritual practice because we feel like a sort of pain or existential weight or want clarity, and we want it to be easier. So we get involved in spiritual practice to make things easier. And that's pretty much the whole part of the conceit of the wellness movement is this sort of like, we need to make it easier because this is hard. But spiritual practice does not make things easier. It makes things harder if you do it right. What it does is it creates the capacity for you to sit with suffering. It creates compassion for yourself and others to be able to sit with suffering, to sit with the pain, to sit with the dissonance, and to examine yourself in ways that are painful. And you can do that and then opt out at any point. And when stuff's coming up, like we're so filled with shadows and projections that when we see stuff's coming up and we're like, oh, I have these wayward gay thoughts, but gay's bad, so I'm going to go beat up gay people. That can happen as a result of contemplative practice, right? Mm-hmm. Contemplative practice could unlock that. And you don't have to work through that. You could just become an evil, oppressive jerk and still be doing contemplative practice. Kathleen writes, I like Julia's notion of feral Christian.
Yep,
that's I saw a post recently from Julia. That's how you self designate.
Yes,
like that.
Yes,
we are nerds.
We are nerds. Yes,
I'm all for
it. Great thing.
Mark writes, mystical solipsism is a very real danger. Mm-hmm. Mike has a link to, I think, the book about New Thought. From Gary Lachman, Dark Star Rising.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Ceres writes, catharsis is not necessarily mean there's actual healing. It's a lot of times trauma porn. I mean, there's a lot of stuff, again, on anti-racism and catharsis and how there's an industry selling catharsis to white people rather than selling anti-racist practice. And that, I'm seeing this come up more and more, and it's really heavy stuff. Julie writes, maybe the Trump rallies and charismatic movement experiences feel mystical because we lack in so many communal activities in this age.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. And I also think that it just, look, emotional release is a powerful thing, and it, people, as Mark, you're saying, people do want to feel better. People do want to feel better.
Yeah, who doesn't? Like, it's not wrong to want to feel better.
Right, yeah.
And emotional uppers. Like, it's so funny to me growing up in rural Minnesota with all these stoic farmers who don't even know how to hug their children sometimes. Then seeing that same person kick the chair back, getting sweaty from dancing with a rapturous look on their face. And then they start crying. And you want to think that that's somehow healing and making it more possible for them to experience emotion with their family, but that's not how it works. I think there's a capacity. I still think of myself in a lot of levels as charismatic. So I think one can engage in that spiritual practice in a way that opens up capacity for emotionality and physicality and sensuality. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't work that way. Just like you can just get every Trump supporter to start doing 20 minutes of centering prayer, and it doesn't mean they're going to turn into progressives. That's not how it works. Stephen writes, the line between genius and insanity seems comparable to the line between mystical experience and self-delusion or collective delusion. So what's the barometer for gauging whether your experience is deluded catharsis or genuine expansive connection?
Yes, so exactly. And so that's where the work of community, the work of accountability, the work of discernment, the work of reflecting on teachings comes into play. Because exactly, human beings are capable of infinite self-delusion. I mean, you know, the mystics have realized that for forever. Yeah, that's our superpower. And so when you are doing this on your own, or when you're doing it in a community that, let's say, is isolated or has adopted a certain set of values or is unconscious about its own self-reflection, it's very easy to get lost. And so, that's the challenge of continually engaging. And look, we, you know, we're talking a lot about Christianity right now. You see this in every sect, right? In every religion. I mean, Buddhists, right? The people that, you know, invented super incredible contemplative practice, you know, the Sri Lankan Buddhists, you know, became this incredibly violent, oppressive killers of the minorities in their country. And, you know, same thing what we're talking about Bernard, you know, they kind of missed the boat on something. And so, yeah, I mean, it is not a particular to any one religious system. It's particular to human beings. And so that's the thing that we're need to kind of constantly be on the awareness for, watch for. All right, we're over time.
The subtext sounds like white evangelical Christianity is fascist. How did you get that?
Ding, ding, ding. The winner of the secret teaching.
Well, it's a yes and, because this strand. I wish it was only white evangelicalism that was like this, because that would make it easy just to kind of like create a wall and put every evangelical Christian inside of it or something. I don't know. But that's not how it works, unfortunately. Somebody nailed something, according to Wiley. Kathleen writes, I went to a U2 concert a few years ago. It felt like a peak religious experience for me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Great concerts are awesome.
Stefan writes, some contemporary philosophers have written against empathy on its own because it's biased. Yeah. We empathize more for similar people, for example, racially, religiously, culturally, geographically, etc. And to replace it with rational, universal compassion, right-wing empathy community is strong but biased. I agree. I think there's a lot of people say we need empathy, as though, again, empathy itself is a quality.
The magic key.
Magic, and that's not true. Like, there are people with less capacity for empathy who are righteous and kind, and there are people with great capacity for empathy who have oodles of it, who misdirect it and do damage. So part of this thing is, like, if you're going to do contemplative practice, remember that part of the goal is it can allow you to be uncomfortable more. Like, that's what part of it is. That sounds very struggly, but that's kind of, we need to be able to look into the shadows. And that's where contemplative practice can help, but it's not going to make us free of shadows. Wiley writes, but even the mysticism of blackness is rooted in an idea of blackness. Blackness has always been an ever-evolving social construct. Yep.
Yeah, all these things are.
Catherine writes, scrupulously OCD, where spiritual thinking and practice becomes consuming compulsions, is another example of ways mysticism can become toxic and oppressive. The only cure is letting go of achieving perfection or certainty. Julia writes, catharsis experience is new addiction. I think it can be very addictive.
Oh, absolutely. It's incredibly addictive.
And be a substitute for change.
No.
Of any sort of material way, which is dangerous right now.
No.
Eva writes, this discussion echoes addiction and recovery.
No.
It's interesting. Yeah, Julia and you both bringing up this comment. That's good timing. 100%. Sarius writes, I don't think we are pointing to how patriarchy influences this dilemma. You're right.
Enough.
Oh, I agree. I think that's a fair point. Because there's definitely a patriarchal quality to this.
It's one of the root
hierarchical domination systems.
Absolutely. All right. Well, blaze through another time. Thank you very much. Great comments as always. Really appreciate all of you. Mm-hmm. So have a great weekend.
And we'll see you next week, everybody.
See you next week. Bye.
Bye.